A few years ago, the writer Jeff Goodell climbed the Madero's volcano in Nicaragua. This was in May, and it was hot, but nothing crazy. Goodell was in good shape, and in his book, he said the idea that he could get heat stroke seemed about as likely to him as being abducted by aliens.
The day we set out, it was hot, but not the kind of day where you would think, I'm going to just sit inside by the air conditioning. I don't know what the temperature was. Maybe it was in the high 80s or something like that, but it was very humid. We headed out in the morning. I think it was about a 5 or 6 hour hike up the side of this volcano. And, you know, I was in my 40s. I was in excellent shape. It was just very carefree adventure. And we started climbing. And after, I don't know, an hour or so of climbing, I noticed that my heart started pounding faster than it should be for a hike like that. But I didn't think about it, and I was sweating, but, you know, it was humid, so of course I was sweating. But then I kept going, and I kept going. And then my heart just started kind of exploding in my chest. And I got lightheaded. And sweat started pouring off my body in a way that was really surreal. It was as if my sweat pores had sort of just all opened up, and within the course of a few minutes, I was just drenched with sweat. And I didn't have the sense to stop. I slowed down a little bit, but I kept going. And then my heart started pounding faster and faster, and I got dizzy, and I was on the verge of passing out. Then all of a sudden, the sweating stopped. I got clammy and dizzy. Luckily, the guide I was with had some inkling of what was going on and sat me down in some shade. And after some period of time, I don't know, half an hour, 45 minutes or something, my body calmed down. But I only realized in retrospect how dangerous of a situation I was in, that my body was really on the verge of something like a heat stroke. And it was terrifying because of the sense of loss of control. I've never experienced anything like that before, where it felt like my body was in a full-scale panic. I've been writing about climate change for 20 years, and I think at the time that I did this climb in Nicaragua, I had been writing about it for 10 years or something like that. And I understood the idea of heat in a very abstract way. I wrote about climate change, and of course the phrase global warming gives you some hint that, you know, heat has something to do with it. But like a lot of people who write about or think about climate change, it always seemed like a kind of distant event. I had been to the Arctic. I'd seen glaciers melting. I understood the risks of sea level rise. I had been to places where there was crop failure. I understood drought. I understood a lot of things. But it never felt personal. Perhaps that's partly because I'm a middle-class person. But this experience on the volcano in Nicaragua showed me how wrong I was, how I had misinterpreted and misunderstood the risks of climate change and the risks especially of extreme heat, and how heat was not just some movement of mercury in a thermometer and the difference between, you know, going to the beach and not going to the beach, or putting on a long sleeve shirt or short sleeve shirt or a jacket or shorts. It was a matter of life and death.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Jeff Goodell's book is called The Heat Will Kill You First. It's about how heat works, how heat shaped life, and how the intense temperatures we're encountering these days, like that wave we all felt these past few weeks, is different. In fact, Goodell says the goal of the book is to get us to think about heat in a different way.
Let's start with how we think about weather. right? Just before I started recording this today, I took an Uber. And the first thing the Uber driver asked me when I got in was, he asked me about the weather and what I thought about the heat here in Texas, where I am. And so thinking about heat and thinking about weather is part of our everyday conversations. It everyone talks about it all the time.
Yeah.
But we think about it in a kind of degrees of comfort and things like that. When we think about heat, heat is generally something that most people, not all, but most people like warmer rather than colder weather. People like to go to vacations to beaches and lay in the sun and feel the warmth. They like to sit by the pool. They like to be in flip-flops. I mean, this is a kind of general human quality that we all have, or many of us have. And furthermore, our whole language is very confused about how we think about heat. If you go out for dinner or to an event and you meet somebody who's attractive, you know, you might call him or her hot. And that's an endorsement, right? For years, I worked at Rolling Stone magazine. Every summer, we would put out a hot issue. And that was not about climate change. That was about music and about movies and about books and TV shows and things like that.
Yeah.
So even in our language, the phrase hot, you know, connotates things that we like. And the last part of this is the way the media talks about this, right? Heat is an invisible thing. I'm looking out the window right now in my office in Texas, and I can't tell if it's 70 degrees or 120 degrees just by looking outside, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And when the media talks about a heat wave coming, what they'll often show is images of people at the beach or kids playing in fountains or eating ice cream cones or things like that. So it doesn't register. The whole idea of heat registers with us in very kind of complicated ways. And the goal of my book is to really kind of reset that and to invite readers to think about heat as this kind of deadly force, but also to think about heat in the larger kind of planetary way as the kind of primary driver behind all of the sort of climate impacts that we're more familiar with, things like droughts and sea level rise and crop failures and you know, more intense hurricanes, bigger wildfires. All of those things are driven by rising heat levels on the planet.
One thing that really got me early on in the book, you say the amount of heat generated by our consumption of fossil fuels is kind of difficult to wrap your head around. But one way you explain it is by showing one particular measure that showed the ocean was absorbing the equivalent of heat released from 3 nuclear bombs every second.
Right. And, you know, I think that example you chose is compelling and powerful, but even that doesn't communicate really the scale and the scope of what these temperature changes mean on our planet. You know, I think that, you know, one of the hardest things to grasp about the climate crisis is the sort of scope and scale of what we're talking about. Mm. You know, and it's very easy to, you know, hear scientists talk about, you know, these targets of 1.5°C of warming Celsius. First of all, most people don't even know what Celsius means and how that translates into Fahrenheit and things like that. There's all that problem. But also, you know, the difference between 1.5°C and 2°C seems like nothing, just like the difference between 70 degrees and 75 degrees or 73 degrees. I mean, for most people, it's like, who cares? Yeah. It doesn't seem to make any difference. And yet, when you look at it on a kind of planetary scale, and when you look at it on what it means to various ecosystems, from, you know, the Amazon rainforest to the ice sheets to the migration of mosquitoes carrying malaria into your neighborhood, these small changes have enormous consequences. And that's part of the difficulty of writing a book like this, is communicating about why what seem like small changes have enormous consequences.
Early in the book, and really throughout, there are these cautionary tales One of the first is the story of a family living in Mariposa, California. It's in the Sierra Nevada foothills. A mother, a father, their one-year-old daughter. Before we talk about the story, just tell us what happened first so we can get into the details.
As you mentioned, it was a family who was living in the foothills of the Sierras in California, not far from Yosemite. In fact, you could see El Capitan, the granite dome in Yosemite from the second floor of their house. They had moved up to the Sierra foothills during the pandemic, and they had moved up there because they wanted to be closer to nature. They had a 1.5-year-old daughter. They wanted to raise her out of the hubbub of the Bay Area. And they had only lived in this new house that they bought for a short amount of time, less than a year. And they were still exploring the world around them. And they were competent outdoors people. They were in good health. They went for hikes all the time. They had good gear. They were not the kind of person you would all think is vulnerable to anything like extreme heat. They planned a 7-mile hike the night before. Richard Gerrish, the man in the family, the husband and father, got a call from his brother who warned him that it was going to be hot the next day and to make sure that they leave early and carry plenty of water. And Richard said, you know, don't worry, we'll be fine. I know how to deal with heat. I understand this. They left early in the morning at about 7:30. They hiked down into a canyon. They played around at the river in the canyon. And then they had about a 2.5-mile hike up the other side of the canyon. And that other side of the canyon was a southern exposure, so direct sunlight. There had been a wildfire that ripped across the side of that canyon a year earlier. So there was basically no shade, no cover at all. And make a long story short, they didn't return from their hike. Yeah. And their families and friends got worried. They sent out a search party. And the entire family, the Richard, his wife, their 1.5-year-old child, and their dog, were all found dead on the trail all together. And it took a month of investigation to realize they all died of heat stroke as they were trying to climb out of this canyon on this hot day in California.
Now, we can talk more about the details of that story, but I wanted to just kind of add or include another story, and not to substitute this one, but to illustrate how there are stories like this throughout the West. Because here in Utah, last week, a 56-year-old woman died apparently because of the heat while hiking near this reservoir in southern Utah. Just a few days before that, a 30-year-old woman died in 106-degree heat, also in southern Utah, in a place called Snow Canyon. A few days before that, a 52-year-old man and his 23-year-old daughter died when they ran out of water, also in the southern part of the state, in 100-plus-degree heat. And I guess this is the reason to tell the story that you tell from California, and the reason I mention these ones in Utah, because as the sort of chapter heading implies, these are cautionary tales, I suppose.
Yeah, they are. And I really wanted to, this is, you know, the opening chapter of the book is the telling of this story. And I really wanted to tell it right up front, because I think when people think about, you know, heat and heat risks, it's something that, you know, if they think about it at all, they think might impact, you know, the people who are working on the highways in the middle of summer, or roofers, or, you know, every once in a while, you read in the online or in a newspaper about a postal worker or a delivery worker or something who succumbs to heat, or sometimes even sports players, football players. But the idea that it's something that everyone can be impacted by, that even youngish people in good shape who are on some level aware of the risks, you know, not unlike the story I told about myself climbing that volcano in Nicaragua, can be overtaken so quickly. Heat can be dangerous for everyone.
You say in the book that the human body is a heat machine. Talk about what you mean. Explain how the human body, you know, as an organism, manages heat. This is kind of an important part of the story that you tell early on in the book.
You know, everyone understands how important temperature is for our health. First thing that the doctor does when you go to the doctor, if you're not feeling well or something, is they take your temperature.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very important for the metabolic function of our body to stay in a very narrow range of temperature. You know, 98.6, it can fluctuate to 98, 99. All that is within the range, but really it's like a 1 or 2 degree range. It's very, very precise. And so what happens when you're exposed to heat is that your internal body temperature starts to move up. And as your internal body temperature starts to move up due to this heat, and in some cases exercise, then your body has to start dumping heat. And we really only have one mechanism, and it works pretty well. But there's only really one mechanism to do that, which is, as everyone knows, we sweat.
Yeah.
So when our internal temperature starts to rise, what our body does is that your heart starts pumping faster. It starts pumping blood away from your internal organs towards the surface of your skin so that it'll get a higher volume of blood to the surface of the skin so it can be cooled off, and then it gets recirculated through your body. And as long as the temperature it doesn't get too hot, that works pretty well. But as soon as you get into a situation where that heat dumping system of sweat can't keep up, then your body temperature starts to rise. And, you know, if it rises to 101, 102, you begin to get lightheaded. You know, you feel the heart pounding in your chest kind of feeling. And if you don't get out of the heat, then your body temperature will continue to escalate. It's like a runaway nuclear reactor, really. And that's kind of what I felt on that climb on the volcano in Nicaragua. Your body temperature will continue to escalate. And as it does, your body gets into more and more trouble. The blood is pulled away from your brain, trying to get it out to the surface of your skin. That's often why people will pass out in the heat. If you fall onto the hot ground, that will increase your temperature even more. Once you get up to around 104, 105 degrees, you're getting into heat stroke territory. What happens then is, you know, very grisly, yeah. Really. The actual cell membranes within your body begin to melt. You begin hemorrhaging inside. The proteins that control a lot of the cellular functions of your body begin to kind of unfold. And your body literally melts or unravels from the inside out. And that's why heat stroke is so dangerous and so difficult to recover from. And if people get help, you know, midway through a heat stroke, they can often have permanent damage because that cellular unraveling and things will cause permanent damage and kind of can't be put back together again. The only effective way to deal with a heat stroke or heat exhaustion is by cooling off your inner body temperature. And the only way to do that is to get as fast as possible into a cool space, whether that means just the shade of a tree or whether it means jumping in a cold shower, jumping in a creek, putting your feet in cold water. You know, during the extreme heat event in the Pacific Northwest in 2021, hospitals were getting so many people who were on the verge or in the process of having heat strokes, they kept body bags full of ice. Yeah. And what they would do when people came in is they would put them into the body bag filled with ice. That was the only way that they could get their core body temperature down fast enough to save their lives.
Jeff Goodell. We're talking about his book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer Jeff Goodell talking about his book, The Heat Will Kill You First. Goodell writes about how heat works, what it is, the way it shaped life. He says heat is an active force that can kill you before you understand what's happening. It's also the prime mover of the climate crisis, and the heat we're enduring these days is beyond anything we've reckoned with before. Let's talk about how heat shaped us. It's the name of one of the chapters in the book. How have we lived with heat in the past? This is one of the parts where you sort of go back, as you say, to the beginning of things. Talk about this part of the story.
Well, heat has been a very powerful force in shaping not only us as humans, but all living things. Yeah. You know, in my book, I talk about the various strategies that other animals have evolved to deal with heat, whether it's, you know, hippos spending the day, you know, in ponds and water and then only kind of coming out at night, to the way that bees build their hives and create this very sophisticated ventilation system, which they power through the flapping of their wings. You know, every living creature, whether it's a bee or a human or a redwood tree or a mosquito, you know, has what I describe in the book as a Goldilocks zone, which is this zone, this range of temperatures that they can thrive in. And every living thing needs to stay in that Goldilocks zone somehow. It's very straightforward. If you get out of the Goldilocks zone, you have to move to a cooler place. There are many examples of animals and of course, people migrating to cooler places, yeah. Frogs moving higher up the mountain, things like that to cooler. If you don't, you die. But it's also shaped us in literally the shapes of our bodies. People who have evolved in very hot places tend to be taller and thinner than people who have evolved in colder places, because the tallness and the thinness allows more body surface to evaporate the heat.
So humans become good at adapting, good hot weather hunters. You also explore that. But all of those strategies were developed for that Goldilocks zone that you mentioned, that we'd been living in for the last 10,000 years or so. So what does this new world of heat mean for human bodies? Do we know yet?
Well, you know, one of the big difficulties here is that we are heating up our world far too fast for evolution to keep up. Yeah. Certainly human evolution. If you're a microbe that's replicating millions of times every day, that's a different story. But for humans, on human timescales, you know, evolution is not going to be any help. Our bodies are not going to change and adapt fast enough to the rate of warming, which is roughly 100 times faster than scientists have seen in any other warming event in Earth's past. We are not going to be able to kind of evolve into sort of better sweaters or thinner, more heat-tolerant people in any kind of meaningful way that will give us any kind of evolutionary advantage in this rapidly warming world that we're building for ourselves.
This is how you put it in the book. You said, we're like actors in Hollywood's silent era who suddenly find ourselves cast in speaking roles. Like this is a totally new context that we have to figure out, I guess.
Yes, thank you for reading that line. I'd forgotten about that line. We are heating up our world very, very fast, and it is changing everything, and it's going to change everything, and it is changing everything about our survival strategies. And by that, I don't just mean like our ability to sweat and our ability to kind of keep within thermal limits. I mean everything, like how we grow our food and where we get our energy and what kind of diseases we're going to be facing. The kind of broader evolutionary challenges of living in this changed world is what is really at stake here. And, you know, part of the bigger evolutionary problem with this is not so much our physical evolution of, like, can we learn to sweat better and all that, but is the psychological aspect of it. Yeah. Can we, as these humans that have evolved in this relatively slow-moving, stable climate, think differently about how our world is changing, and can our brains adapt to this as much as our bodies?
You also write about what human migration is going to look like. One of the We have a clue when you look at the Dust Bowl. You mentioned an economics professor from the University of Chicago, Richard Hornbeck, who's been making this argument about how the Dust Bowl gave us a sense of how humans behave in moments like this. And the thing that he argues is that we don't necessarily adapt to changing conditions by, you know, different, as he said, different plows and different crops. What we did was we just left.
Right.
We just headed to California. So what do you think that means for – because you spend some time talking about, you know, human migration, you know, the question of temperature apartheid, those kinds of things. What's the – what have you learned about that?
Well, the big thing I've learned is that, you know, human migration is perhaps the most complex part of our response to this rising heat and to the climate changes that we're seeing. You're right about the Dust Bowl. We did, you know, farmers did move in there, had no idea about the kind of farming techniques that would be most suited to the prairie. They tore up all the topsoil. That topsoil dried up and blew away, and they just left, and that was it. And we're going to go start again somewhere else. And, you know, we as you know, a human civilization don't really have the luxury of doing that on, certainly on the planet, on a planetary scale, but even on a micro and regional scales, right? I mean, our world is much more complicated than that right now. And how we're going to deal with migration is such a complex issue. I mean, look what's happening right now with the election. I mean, we have a presidential election happening. Obviously, everyone knows the number one issue is borders, and the number one issue is immigration and migration. And, you know, the political complexities of this on every side of the issue are so deep and so profound. And you can see how destabilizing immigration and migration can be to political systems. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that is not usually talked about when we think about things like extreme heat and climate change. Yes, you know, the idea of migration and things is sometimes talked about. But the ramifications of that migration and the idea that, you know, in certain ways for the right wing, not just in America, but for Europe and around the world, you could argue that, you know, the climate chaos works in their favor, because then it allows them to talk about things like building walls and keeping people out and riling people up for that reason. And that's a very powerful political force. And, you know, so the kind of cascading complexities of the climate crisis are what is most difficult to sort of wrap our minds around.
Well, there's a really great chapter about air conditioning, which has a political dimension that had not occurred to me. You write about how air conditioning changed the landscape of America and opened up this new, I think how you put it, new frontier of migration and development, and the political ramifications of now all of a sudden this big demographic shift, this flood of conservatives who moved to the South, that changed the balance of power in American politics. Like, they were fleeing or they were, you know, because they could now move to the South because there was air conditioning, conservatives moved there. And Richard Nixon understood it. And it just changed the cultural context of this country. That was remarkable, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, air conditioning is a much underestimated kind of political force in American history. You know, we think about the power of states like I live in Texas, where I live right now, but also Florida and, you know, the whole southern tier of the United States. There would not be, you know, Miami Beach as we know it today without air conditioning. There would not be Houston and Austin, where I live, as we know it today, without air conditioning. It has been a tool that has allowed us in a certain way to defeat heat. It is a, you know, a heat-trumping tool, right? I mean, no presidential pun there. It allows you to live inside of a bubble that allows you to pretend that heat doesn't matter. You know, I've given hundreds of talks since my book has been published, and inevitably someone will say something to the effect of, Jeff, I understand, you know, a lot of what you're talking about, but really, what's the big deal? We just need to get more people air conditioners, and this problem will be solved. And, you know, this plays into the American idea of a technofix, that if we just develop the right gizmo, the kind of iPhone for extreme heat, we'll solve this problem. And I point out that, you know, there are 750 million people on the planet who don't even have access to electricity, much less air conditioning. And they are, for all intents and purposes, never going to have access to air conditioning. You know, furthermore, we're not going to air condition the oceans. We are not going to air condition the forests. We are not going to air condition the fields where our food crops are grown. So air conditioning has been this powerful force, but it's also been a powerful sort of engine of denial and delusion about what we're really facing.
Jeff Goodell, we're talking about his book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the writer Jeff Goodell. We're talking about his book, The Heat Will Kill You First. Help us understand basically a heat wave, because you mentioned in the book that you have to first understand the nature of heat itself. So maybe take us through this, because one of the questions you work through is, what is heat? We'll get to the cosmic nature of heat in a moment, but what is heat?
Well, you know, that's a question I asked myself, you know, not long after my adventure on the volcano in Nicaragua. When I realized how dangerous heat could be, I also realized that even though I had been writing about climate change for a long time, I couldn't explain what heat was. I knew what temperature was. I knew what a thermometer did. But if you asked me, what is heat, I could not have told you. And that was one of the motives for me writing this book, was to kind of try to explain that and think about that and understand why it's so important. And, you know, the short version of it is heat is vibration.
Yeah.
Heat is molecules moving faster. So when you pick up a coffee cup and you feel the warmth in your fingertips, nothing physical is being transferred through from the coffee to the coffee cup to your fingers. All that's happening is the molecules that are in the coffee are moving faster, which is vibrating the molecules in the cup of the coffee, which are then in turn vibrating the molecules in your fingertips, which are registering in your brain as heat. And so when you think about a hotter world, you can think about it as a world with a higher, that is vibrating faster, with a higher metabolic rate, that is sort of more excited and more excitable than a cooler world.
One of the ways you write about to limit the damage of heat, I mean, beyond, of course, limiting the burning of fossil fuels, is to, as you say, think differently about how we build things. Talk a little bit about this part. You mentioned, for example, the way older buildings, the way they were built, that people managed to understand and work with airflow in a way that we just, for some reason, we're not thinking about that in the same way.
Yeah, the reason we're not thinking about that in the same way is because of air conditioning.
Yeah. The technology of forgetting, I think, is how you put it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I see examples of that, how we used to build buildings and think differently about this, right here in Texas where I live. You know, I will drive or walk by older houses here, and, you know, we still have what they call dog trot houses, where they had a big, wide breezeway between the sort of two halves of the house that would allow cooling breezes to come through. They would orient the houses so that they would capture those breezes. They would plant big trees around the house to give it shade. I was recently in Galveston in touring one of these spectacular Victorian mansions there. And they had incredibly elaborate uses of transoms to funnel hot air up, ventilation in the ceiling to get release that hot air, cool water circulating through the basement to cool things down there, circulating some of the airflow across that cool water and then up through the house, a kind of primitive geothermal system. They would have no windows on the sunniest side of the location so that it didn't absorb heat. We had porches that allowed you to be outdoors. I mean, we knew how to deal with heat. People understood how to build with heat. And, you know, what air conditioning has done is allowed us to forget all of that and to put all that aside. Now, buildings are built out of steel and wood, but with no thought to solar orientation, with no thought to breezes, with no thought about, you know, natural ventilation flow. I mean, I feel this all the time whenever I'm traveling in the United States and I check into a hotel and the windows are sealed shut and you cannot open the windows. Yeah. And you have this ancient air conditioning machine that's clanking along and you're forced to either sleep with this clanking machine by your bed or else turn the air conditioner off and basically, you know, suffocate because there's no ventilation in it. So, you know, air conditioning has really changed how we think about buildings, and it has made us much more dependent upon that. I wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times a couple of weeks ago talking about this in hot cities, especially like Phoenix, and how dangerous a blackout could be during a heat wave in a city like Phoenix, where paradoxically, you have almost 99% penetration of air conditioning, which, okay, that makes it, you know, more hospitable on the hot, hot summers that Phoenix has. But then if that air conditioning goes out during one of those heat waves, the homes and offices that are dependent upon it become like convection ovens because they have no other ventilation system. So again, it's this sort of double-edged sword of air conditioning and how it has shaped our lives.
You also say in the book that the way we communicate about extreme heat is often distorted by the sense of nostalgia for a climate that no longer exists.
Yeah.
I thought this was really interesting, just culturally. I think you say the love of heat is in our genes. Like there was this, I think it was some study that found that the preferred temperature for most humans is they want to be in 72 degrees, you know, with low humidity. We love warm weather, but that's a kind of nostalgia for something that is not realistic anymore in real ways.
Well, first of all, let me just say I'm so happy you brought that up because, like, I have done hundreds of interviews for this book. You're the first person who's picked out that statistic, and that is my favorite statistic in the entire book, my favorite factoid. And you only described half of it, though. So, yes, there was a study that looked at, you know, what is the kind of preferred setting that people set their houses at? If they could put the temperature anywhere, what would that temperature be? And what would the humidity be? What is the sort of ideal temperature for humans? Yeah. And they found out, as you pointed out, that it's about 72 degrees and, you know, dry, not 72 degrees and humid. Yeah. But the fascinating thing about the second half of the study is they looked at, okay, so what natural climate most mimics the climate that people have chosen as their chosen climate. And it turns out that the climate that most mimics the one that we choose today with our thermometer, with our, you know, thermostats, is the Rift Valley in Africa, which is where humans evolved out of.
So you said earlier, we cannot air condition, you know, the drying forests. We can't air condition the planet. But why not?
Yeah. So first I should say that I wrote a book about this called How to Cool the Planet that came out about 10 years ago. It was a book, shall we say, ahead of its time. But this idea of geoengineering is really interesting. It's really dangerous. It's really scary. And it's sort of oddly hopeful at the same time. So it's a complicated subject, so let me just talk about it briefly. And David Keith is a scientist, a very good scientist, an atmospheric scientist, who has been taken by this idea that, you know, he often quotes Stuart Brand, the Bay Area entrepreneur and founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, who inspired Steve Jobs, who said, we're already, you know, managing the planet. We may as well get good at it. So the idea is, can we think about ways to manage the planet in a meta way that can reduce some of this heat and offset these problems of climate change that we're talking about and the higher levels of CO2? Mm. And one of the ways that I write about in this book, and I explore in more detail in my previous book, How to Cool the Planet, is about this notion of spraying small particles in the stratosphere that would reflect away a smaller amount of sunlight. All you would have to do is reflect away 1 or 2% of the sunlight, and it would drop the, you know, average temperature on the Earth by a couple of degrees. It would take the edge off this warming that we've been experiencing. Mm. And, you know, this is, in some sense, could be the beginning of some sort of kind of global parasol, some kind of global shade system. And, you know, it's gotten some, well, it's gotten a lot of scientific interest, partly because we know it works, because it's essentially what volcanoes do. Mm. Volcanoes shoot a bunch of particles into the stratosphere when they erupt. Mount Pinatubo in 1992 lowered the average temperature of the Earth by, you know, over a degree for more than a year after its eruption. Mm. And so what we're talking about is essentially building what amounts to an artificial volcano. And this could be, the engineering aspect of this is not terribly complex. It would require a modest fleet of high altitude aircraft that would be flying around and spraying this stuff high up in the stratosphere. And it's a engineering solution that is imaginable. Hmm. But now let me say that the dark side of this is, we don't know how this would really react. We don't know what impact this would have on, say, the monsoons, yeah, for which millions of people depend on. How will it affect the sort of larger thermodynamics of the weather systems? It opens the door to all kinds of political complexity. Whose hand is on the thermostat? Who decides how much we're going to cool, how much we're not going to cool? Is this going to open a kind of Pandora's box of other sort of backlash problems? Hmm.
You write in the book that looking back at heat waves is easier than looking forward, which gets to this question I think we're all asking. Like, it seems really hot right now. How hot could it get? What have you learned about that?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. One way, the first way is, how hot it can get will depend upon how long we keep putting CO2 into the atmosphere, essentially how long we keep burning fossil fuels, right? Because that is what is causing the rise of temperatures. And, you know, one point that I think is really, really important to make, and that I think a lot of people don't get, is that the temperature on the planet will continue to rise as long as we continue to put CO2 in the atmosphere. And when we stop, when we get to the, you know, much dreamed of net zero carbon, when we're not putting any more carbon into the atmosphere, or any carbon that we are putting in, we're offsetting it by taking some out in other ways. When we get to this net zero moment, when we stabilize the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, all that is going to do is stop the warming. It is not going to take us back to the climate that you and I, and presumably many of our listeners, grew up in. And the new climate that we're going to live in is going to be much more extreme, much more turbulent, and much more chaotic. So that's one answer to the question. The other answer to the question is something that I really was curious about and explored in the book, which is, given where we are today, just where, like tomorrow, how hot could it get, yeah, in Phoenix or in Austin or in Salt Lake City or in Portland? I mean, we had in the summer of 2021 with the heat domes in the Pacific Northwest, we had a town in British Columbia where the normal kind of summer temperatures in the 70s and 80s get to 120 degrees and, yeah, essentially spontaneously combusted. You know, could we see Salt Lake City with a summer temperature of 135 degrees? Is that physically possible? This is a question that I posed to scientists, and basically they said, yes, it is possible. I mean, we don't know. There's no sort of thermal regulator on the sort of physics of our climate that would prevent that. We are seeing more and more extreme events. How extreme they can get, scientists, people who are thinking about this, don't really know.
I wanted to end, if it's okay, sort of the way you do in the book. And I found it interesting that you come around to telling the story of a trip you took to the Arctic archipelago. And you write about skiing through this landscape that was in motion. You write about the sublime beauty of the place, and but also the how difficult it was up there. And I'm not sure if we want to give away the last moment of the book, but why did you want to end here? For all the things that you could have ended with that would have sounded cataclysmic, it's not exactly where you ended up. Do you mind talking about that?
No, I'd be happy to talk about it. I think that I ended the book with this trip to the Arctic for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, after thinking and writing about climate change as long as I have, one of the things that I've come to understand is, in certain ways, made my life better, if that's not too strange a thing to say, is that I've become much more conscious of the temporariness of the way our world is kind of arranged right now. And the Arctic is a great example of that. It is very, very sensitive to temperature changes. It is moving and shifting all of the time. And when I was up there, I really saw that and felt that. And I see that and feel that every day now. I walk along the beach and I realize this beach is just a temporary arrangement of sand and it's not going to be here long. I've become much more aware of the temporalness of everything around us. This is all in a rapid state of change. And when you see it as in a rapid state of change, you think differently about it, and it becomes sort of, in some way, kind of more precious and more valuable. And that is one aspect of what thinking about climate change has done for me. The other thing that I wrote about in my trip to the Arctic is an encounter with a polar bear. She was a mother polar bear of two cubs, and she was obviously having a hard time getting food. She was very thin. She had two cubs to feed. And in this encounter with this bear, I really got this powerful feeling of, you know, how this moment that we're living through is not just a human moment. It is something that we are all going through. Polar bears are going through, you know, birds are going through, trees are going through. I write about a scientist in my book who has used a microphone to discover that when trees are drought stressed and heat stressed, they actually make a kind of screaming sound within them. And so ending with the Arctic and with my encounter with the polar bear really was a way of trying to open this thinking about this out to something beyond just us, and to see that this is something that, you know, every living thing in the world shares. And there's a certain level of, how do I even put it, guilt that goes along with that, knowing that we humans did this. We humans are the ones who have put this system in motion. And yes, we've done amazing things. And yes, you know, our technological progress, our evolution is a very powerful and important thing. Who knows where it will lead and what ultimately it means. But it has changed the world in ways that, you know, the polar bear that I encountered did not say, you know, yeah, it's okay for you guys to, you know, melt the ice of where I live and I'll be fine. You know, she did not sign off on this. Neither did any other living thing on the planet. And that sense of this sort of larger togetherness of this is, to me, both a kind of another dimension of the tragedy, but also very hopeful, because this is a situation where whoever and whatever causes it, we are all in this together. And I draw a lot of strength and inspiration from that.
Jeff Goodell, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Jeff Goodell, he's a journalist and writer. His latest book is called The Heat Will Kill You First: Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. As always, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at radiowest@KUER.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.